Welcome to Commission Ed, the Air Force Officer Podcast. Here we explore the training and development of America's leaders in the application of air power and the profession of arms. The views expressed are those of the hosts and do not reflect the official policy or position of the United States Air Force, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.
Welcome back to another episode of Commission Ed, the Air Force Officer Podcast. I am Colin Slade.
And I'm Reed Gann. We're your hosts for Commission Ed.
Look at us, Reed. We're going to bring another pilot on the show.
I know. It's almost like we fly planes or stuff, you know? I don't know.
No, actually, I really appreciated Slider taking the time to meet with me. It just happened to be that he and another BYU alumni were in the area. They were doing some testing out on the range, the Utah training and testing range, doing some weapons drop certification, that kind of stuff. And while he was in town, both Slider and next week's interview, Morgan Curden, were able to stop in and do an interview.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I'm glad you're able to get the time with him.
And it was even more impressive because as the interview was taking place, both Slider and Morgan were getting live updates on their phone about this whole coronavirus thing. And as soon as we finished, both those guys pulled chocks. They went straight up to Hill, got in the aircraft and left because they needed to get back to Seymour Johnson so that they could beat everything being canceled and shut down across the globe. So really appreciated them taking the time to do that. And I think on this one, we just got lucky that they were able to do it.
Yeah. And hopefully we'll be able to get some more interviews, albeit it'll be probably over Zoom or some other, you know, medium like that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But I just want to, again, highlight the fact that they didn't have to do this. They took time out of their schedule, their operational schedule, to come and talk about being pilots in the Air Force, and in this context specifically, being pilots in the F-15E Strike Eagle. So appreciate their time, and we'll turn it over to them first to Slider, and then next week we will have Morgan.
All right, let's do it.
Welcome back to another episode of Commission Ed, the Air Force Officer Podcast. I am Colin Slade, and today I am joined by...
Captain Slider Haymond.
Slider, huh?
That's it, yeah.
That could go any number of ways on how you earned that one.
Yeah, you know... It's important to realize that fighter pilots, we all have call signs, you know, and it's kind of how we're known. So Slider's mine, yeah.
All right. So for the remainder of this episode, are we going to go by Clark or are we going to go by Slider?
You know, whatever you slip up to, that's fine. But most people in the Air Force will call me Slider.
Okay. Well, I know you as Clark.
There you go.
So I'll get out of your way and just let you explain a little bit about your background, how maybe we know each other, what you've been doing, you know, for the Air Force, how you got into the Air Force.
Yeah.
Over to you, Clark.
Thanks. So I graduated from Brigham Young University in 2011. We were in the capstone together, I believe. Is that right?
We were.
It wasn't a very good one, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, it was stupid.
if our guy's listening, I'm sure he's not, but I did not like it at all. yeah, I was a manufacturing engineering technology degree, I guess, major, if you will, and never have touched it since.
What?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess there's some aspects of my degree that I've touched, but for the most part, I'd say my degree was not pointless or worthless, but not required for what I'm doing now. So graduated in 2011, and I PCS to Shepherd Air Force Base to start pilot training at INJET, the Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training. And it's pretty cool there where you have multiple nations training together.
Yeah.
So in my class, I had some Germans, Italians, and Americans, and a lot of Guard Reserve guys as well. So kind of a breadth of people. Hopefully they don't all have coronavirus out there now.
Yeah, right.
But... here we are. So pilot training was cool. We can talk about that more in a little bit. I stayed there for Introduction to Fighter Fundamentals,
okay,
which is a 3-month course, still flying the T-38. And then From there, moved to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base to learn to fly the Strike Eagle, F-15E.
Yep.
So that was about a year, and then off to RAF Laken Heath in England, just about 30 minutes east of Cambridge, 2 hours from London, and stayed there for 3 years. Lots of TDYs from there. We saw 30 countries in 3 years.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. Got a six-month deployment in there as well in support of Operation Inherent Resolve.
Where to?
So we were obviously Southwest Asia, flying over Iraq and Syria every day. Yeah. I'll say that my location was pretty nice. And so we were near Abu Dhabi. So that was, it was pretty nice area out there. Yeah, deployed there 6 months and then back to England, finished up my tour there, and then went back to Seymour Johnson to teach, and that's where I'm at now. I've been there for about 2.5 years, and who knows what's next? We'll see.
Okay.
So it's been quite the adventure, and a lot of Goldsboro, North Carolina in my life, which it's there, you know?
It's a thing?
It's a thing. There's worse places. I.e. Holloman, or
you're right. So, are there 15s in Holloman?
No,
I was gonna say I don't think you could go there.
No, we're based out of Mountain Home Air Force Base, Seymour Johnson, and then RAF Laken Heath are our three main ones. Then we got guys at Eglin, Vegas,
some of the test locations
Locations. Yep.
Okay.
There's a couple guys here at Hill as well. So yeah, it's pretty good locations though. All it's been equal. We have some CONUS and some OCONUS, which other airframes don't.
Any F-15s in Korea?
No.
Okay.
They'll do some TSPs type thing. They'll go out there, but no. So yeah, that's the nutshell for Slider, and you know, I've been in for 8 years ish, and I have another 2.5 to go in my commitment. That'll bring me to about 12 total. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. Keeping all doors open and to see what the world brings, you know, and where we end up from there.
Cool. Well, let's go back a little bit and you know, peel back some layers on your experience. We don't need to spend much time talking about ROTC because that's one of the things that I actually...
Yeah, it turns out you
know a little bit about. And so our audience has gotten plenty of that from me. I mean, is there anything from your ROTC experience that stands out to you that is something that you would like to pass on to any of the cadets that are currently going through the program or those that are considering joining ROTC or even for the instructors themselves? And how they might make ROTC more effective or better for the cadets.
Yeah, one of the tactical problems I see with ROTC is, especially for those entering into the the air crew side of the house, is I don't actually lead in the ROTC sense very much. I don't have, as a air crew, my leadership is in flying, in flight leadership. And so my job is I'm in a squadron with... 30 other officers, and we might have 4 enlisted guys in the entire squadron. And as a young lieutenant and captain, I don't actually lead in the traditional sense. I'm actually the bottom of the totem pole, making popcorn and sweeping the bar. And, there's a whole other aspect that I learned. So I didn't get any of that from ROTC. And so the disconnect is...
Oh, come on. Weren't you the snacko at one point?
Well, yeah. Okay, so... Yes, but you know what I mean. The disconnect is in the lessons taught from the instructor cadre is they're very important lessons, but they don't apply to me yet. And it's just a different environment. I remember asking my instructors, like, "Hey, are we going to be like marching and stuff in active duty?"
Yeah.
And like, no, that doesn't exist. And so I moved to Shepherd, and it was nighttime. And I didn't know anything about Shepherd other than there was pilot training there. And so I just hear people marching around at night. I'm like, they told me there wasn't going to be marching, Yeah. It turns out it's like the maintenance training center, so where all the enlisted guys go to train for maintenance as well. So, but, it was very interesting. And I'm like, why am I still doing this stuff? So, you know, I did the honor guard thing. I did, you know, you obviously did the color guard, I believe, right?
Is actually, I didn't.
I thought you did. No, you didn't do that. No. Well, so all that stuff was it was interesting, you know, directly applicable. I'd say no, right? Worthless, definitely not. I think it teaches attention to detail, and it makes you strive for something and better yourself, you know, and might make you stand out a little bit better to potentially get you what you want for your career. So that's good.
And builds the team.
Yeah.
Helps you, you learn how to work with others.
Right.
You know, toward the common goal, yeah.
But I wouldn't take it too seriously is all. You know, like, looking back, we probably thought we were a little too cool for ourselves, you know? So I would just probably... if I were to do it again, I probably would have enjoyed college a little bit more and not focused on it too much. You know, my biggest regret at college is not taking fun classes. You know, I just took what was required to get me done. And now I'm looking back, I'm like, well, that was dumb. Like, why not enjoy it? I'm already here. I already spent the money. Like, let's take stuff that I actually would care about. So that was interesting. So that's kind of the ROTC thing. I think that, as air crew, it's difficult to replicate what you are going to experience in ROTC and at the academy. Really, I mean, anything. So that's like I said, that's a tactical problem that as a cadre that we can maybe look at tackling one day to figure out what we could do to better prepare ROTC cadets or any cadets for that matter. To becoming pilots and air crew for that. So
yeah, no, I totally agree with you. The only thing that I might change on your statement is I don't think it's a tactical problem. I think it's a strategic problem. When we are, as an enterprise, for all Air Force accessions, training our future officers in ways that are not applicable for their your future duty, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. One of the cool project I'm working on right now is I'm working with AFPC on revamping the PICSIM.
Okay, cool.
And essentially the PICSIM has been created to quote unquote prove or allow us to define success as completion of pilot training. So with a varying degree of probability, X student will complete pilot training. So that's the PICSIM. So that's great and all, but as a guy now, you know, two or three, you know, exits down the highway here, that's not the goal line. I need the pilots and the WISOs to continue their progression through IFF and then through the B course and eventually become instructors to then come back and feed the machine.
Right.
So the great people at AFPC, they're understanding this and they want to kind of look at that PICSIM score, and maybe we can use that to predict pilot success through all those goals. And so back to your point, why do we give degrees to engineering students if they never touch it, i.e. me, and there's many people like me, you know Eric Hume and those types of people, right? Maybe what if we found characteristics that, hey, this person is going to be a successful pilot, that's who we want to hire, we need to hire this many, let's give that person a scholarship instead of potentially giving a scholarship to somebody that gets a degree that might not ever be useful, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just an interesting problem set that I'm working through that hopefully we'll see some fruits from that.
Yeah. If anything, if my experience in ROTC, both as a cadet and now as an instructor, has taught me anything, it's that the officer accessions process is broken and that we have not fully identified the competencies that we need our officers to have to begin with. Meaning, like, what does a second lieutenant fresh out of their commissioning source actually need to have to be successful? We have not yet fully defined that. And because we have not fully defined that, we don't know exactly how to train for it,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
So,
well, and to find the right people to fill that.
And then that's the other piece of it is you have to... You have to know what it is that you want, and then you have to know the kind of people that can actually become the thing that you want and then how to get them there.
And it probably didn't identify itself as much until now where we're short on people.
Right.
And it's like, oh, shoot. Like, we need every person to be hired correctly, and we need the right person in the right spot at all times. So it was really interesting, this project I'm working on, when I spoke with the DC Air National Guard and mm-hmm. the folks out there, because when they hire a pilot off the street, that person then goes through pilot training, through IFF, through their B course, and then gets back to their unit, has to do training there. And if they fail in any one of those positions, they lose that person forever.
Right.
And they can't replace it, you know?
Yep.
And they need that person for at least the 10 years plus to, you know, keep revitalizing their blood. And that was very eye-opening to me because, you know, people fail our course and they just move to another airframe, you know? But when it's their lifeblood that they need, that people, it was very eye-opening that we have to get it right. We have to get the ascensions right, and the hiring right, or else we might lose, you know? So
yeah, and to put it into maybe a corporate context, when a company is looking to hire, you know, to hire somebody new, that hiring process actually represents a full dollar amount,
right?
Like $60,000 to $100,000 investment just to get that person hired, because they have to invest in them mm-hmm. with their initial salary. Well, the hiring process itself, they have to pay the recruiter to do the interviews and then have to invest that person in their salary, in the training process,
right,
however long that is, any equipment or uniforms or travel or anything that person has to go through. And if they bug out, you know, either if they fail, get fired or quit or something like
right.
that within the first 6 months, that company is out $100,000 just like that. And then they have to start it all over again.
And that's why they now don't vest people for 3 years in their 401ks and whatnot, you know, to keep people there. Yeah. And us millennials, we like to move.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's a strategic problem.
Yeah, I agree.
That we as an Air Force, if we truly value our officers and what it is that they do, we need to do a better job of selecting the right people, training them in the right way so that they can fill the right sort of competencies on behalf of the Air Force in completing our mission.
Totally agree. Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, I didn't mean for us to spend that amount of time on ROTC, but you know, I think valuable discussion anyhow.
Sure.
What I'd like to do now is talk about your experience at NGEPT. It's something that has come up on the podcast previously, but I've never actually had somebody talk to what it was like being there.
Yeah.
So first of all, explain what NGEPT is. You touched on a little bit, you know, Euro-NATO Joint Jet Pilot Training,
mm-hmm.
where you're working with coalition partners from Europe and other nations to still go through the normal pilot training process. But
right.
I don't want to obviously explain it. But first of all, what is it? Secondly, how do you get into it? And then third, what's it like?
Yeah, so I'll probably botch the history a little bit, but from my understanding, I don't know when it started, but essentially we're a part of NATO, right? The North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And as a partner in there, we as a group, NATO, devised a pilot training where they can each send their students to a pilot training to train. So they not only send students, but they also send instructors. So the people that I flew with, Canada, Spain, Norway, Italy, Germany, the Italians, the Germans were usually the more prominent numbers.
Yeah.
And some countries send more than others. Like we had a Turkish instructor, but there was there was no Turkish students there at the time. And so what's cool, though, is that you get to surround yourself with people from other countries with a common language, right? Everyone's speaking English, but not everyone speaks it the same, you know?
Yeah,
and
right.
So there's a lot of language barriers. And I couldn't imagine going to France and, you know, I don't speak French, but let's even call it Spain. I speak Spanish. So I couldn't imagine going to Spain and doing pilot training there, even though I know the language. Like, that would be extremely difficult. So that layer in and of itself is pretty impressive for the students that come from other countries that go there.
Yeah, they must have a minimum level of competency in English as a second language before they can even be considered for it. Right?
I would imagine they have to take a test of some sort. I don't remember if they do or not. And it was actually interesting to see the different accents and, you know, like the Norwegians, their English is just about perfect. Right. You know, it's incredible. So anyway, that was an interesting part. But so then you had the same problem with the instructors, though. So I'm my instructors, English is a second language as well. So
yeah,
there is a barrier there and a communication that you have to fight through as a student to understand what's going on. So it just it makes it for a very interesting time. So the timeline is about the same as any other pilot training. So the other ones are at Enid, Oklahoma. So that's Vance Air Force Base, Del Rio, Texas, down at Laughlin Air Force Base, and then Columbus, Mississippi at Columbus Air Force Base. So
and those each of those is the normal undergraduate pilot training.
Yep. You'll hear it usually SUPT. So okay. Specialized undergraduate pilot training is usually how they call those. And so those are all usually mostly American, but there are some international influence in those other pilot trainings as well, like Iraqis and some of the Italians go to Del Rio as well. So it just kind of depends. So it's not like it's very unique at INJEPT, but there are other countries there that might not be elsewhere. So Still fly the T6 to start off with. So 6 months, the T6. The difference at INJEPT is there's no T1. So there's just the T38. So, which is going to be actually the fact for all pilot trainings here within the next year.
Really?
T1's going away. Yeah. Not sure what they're doing with that yet, but there we are. So you go from the T6 to the T38. Doesn't mean you're going to get a fighter or a bomber, but to be able to fly a fighter, you have to fly a T38 first. So instead of the traditional track select where you might go T1s, you might go to Hueys, you might go to T38s, you just go to T38. So you know right out the bat that you're going to fly that. So
anybody that gets selected for NJEPT knows that they're either going to end up in a fighter or a bomber.
No. So that used to be the case.
Okay.
But that is no longer the case. So they do send guys to heavies from there. And usually they're ACC assets, i.e. RJs or AWACS, sometimes AFSOC type stuff. But it is not guaranteed anymore. So now I'd say, you know, they only send the top 10% of those that apply there. I don't know. Again, going back to our previous, discussion, why? Because I got good grades and I brown nose my commander. I go to INJEPT, you know, like that just for me that as now I'm looking backwards, I'm like, I want the best people to be pilots and I want the best people to potentially go to INJEPT to make everything better. So anyway, but there you have it. There is some sort of selection to get into INJEPT. I'm not sure. You probably are more familiar with now the percentages of what is weighted more importantly than others stuff, whether it's physical fitness or all those things.
Like any other selection process in the Air Force, it is going to change year to year based on the number of slots available. And so trying to pin down the order of merit on INJEPT or any other competitive thing is nearly impossible.
Right. It's always changing.
Always changing, moving target.
Yep.
If there is anybody listening to this that is interested in going to INJEPT, that I'll give you the same advice that I would anybody else. Just be the best that you possibly can. Just like what you're alluding to, that we want the best people in these programs, not just those that meet the quote-unquote minimums.
Totally.
For that order of merit.
And you can't control other people. You know, you can only control yourself and how well you do. And there's things that even part of that you can't control.
Sure.
You know? Your commander might not like you. Sorry, man. You know, like that's just,
right.
That is life. So anyway, the same goes in T6s. So, and T38. So you guys just got to do your best and hope for the best that the right aircraft are available. And so what happens is when you're reaching towards the end of your T38 time, you are given a list of the available aircraft, and then you kind of rack and stack those to your preference. Typically, they'll then take the top guy, and they'll put him in his or her number one spot and kind of work their way down. Any rack and stack type thing would work. I think they do a little horse trading between the different bases, like, hey, we didn't get any Vipers. This guy really wants to go to the F-16. You know, can we give you an F-15 and kind of and make it work? But that process also is interesting. I've heard stories of well below average classes getting a high number of fighters just because that was what happened that time.
And yeah. Because that was the aircraft that was available.
Yeah. It's tough because
they needed more pilots in that particular area.
Right. That whole part of the AFPC process is a kind of conundrum and needs to be worked for sure. It needs to be looked at and adjusted because we need to give commanders the power to pull more fighters when they need them and to push away fighters when they shouldn't have to. You know, when we're putting people in aircraft that they don't belong, it's going to hurt them. They're not going to want to be there. The community doesn't want them anyway.
Right.
And they're not going to get retained down the road. It usually won't work out for the long run for the Air Force. So getting the right people in the right platform is important.
Yeah. It definitely is a tricky thing because here is AFPC, you know, the personnel center trying to look into their crystal ball, project out, hey, 5 years down the road when this officer is finally, you know, fully mission qualified and capable of being a mission leader, an aircraft commander, any sort of position of leadership, that not only are they going to be the right person for that job,
right,
but that also that airframe is going to be available, and that airframe is going to be needed for the particular national security objective at that time.
Right.
So it's a, speaking of a moving target, right?
Yeah, it's a shot in the dark, let's be honest. You know, like, I'm sure there is thought put into it for sure, but it's not always correct, you know.
Yeah, I mean, we've done pretty good up to this point.
Sure. Well, and we had numbers, and that's the difference now.
Okay.
You know, when we're 2,000 pilots short of where we need to be, it's really highlighting the problems. And what we're seeing now in the fighter community specifically is an absorption problem. So we can train now up to 1,400 pilots a year.
Yeah.
The problem is now I don't have enough cockpits to put them in.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to be on a progression so that they become what's called experienced. And once you're experienced, there's different definitions for that for each community. You can then fill other jobs. But until you reach that point, you're not worthless, but you're kind of a drag on the system versus a working cog for the machine.
Yeah, so. And in order to get experienced, they have to be in the cockpit flying a certain number of hours.
Yeah.
You know, checking off the competencies and the capabilities for their aircraft. Yeah. And if they're not getting the hours, they can't provide the Air Force what they need, and that puts an even greater burden on those who are experienced having to meet those requirements for the combat commander and those training missions and those.
Yeah, and as the ball keeps rolling down the hill, you now look at your instructor cadre, who are your core people that can now turn around and create more experienced air crew. They are getting burned out and they're getting overworked. And then as that's all culminating right at the 10-year moment when they now have the opportunity to potentially get out of the Air Force, and they look around and see the other opportunities out there, and it's pretty lucrative for them. And it's like, well, quality of life isn't great. Pay is pretty good. Quality of life's okay over there, and pay is really good over there, you know?
Yeah.
And so our wing commander says that this is a control issue. It's not about money. I'd say it's a little bit of both, but I like his idea that it's a control thing. Like, people want to be able to decide what they're doing next and have that power to decide where their family's going to live, and not getting that 365 to who knows where and being on the hook for those types of things, but being able to control your life and where your family lives.
So, yeah.
It's interesting.
It seems like you're speaking from experience.
Well, I'm still, you know, I just watch it. You know, there, especially in my squadron, all of our instructor cadre are at least in their second assignment, potentially in their third, and some of them are making those decisions now. And so I'm just observing, right, and seeing what's coming along. The important thing, though, is to see that, hey, the mission is getting done. We're working with what we got, but we're actually still winning, right? So that's good. Would we like more resources? Absolutely. Who doesn't? We would love more pilots and WIZOs and continuing through that, but we got to do what we got to do to complete the job, you know? So pilot training in and of itself, though, is pretty interesting to see what they're trying to change. So in JEP, they can't change the syllabus too much because it's kind of NATO driven.
Yeah.
And we got to kind of stay the status quo. But the other pilot trainings are doing a lot of different experiments to potentially see, hey, can we learn faster, better, stronger, and utilize different technologies, emerging technologies to make things better. Pilot Training Next is something I'm sure you've heard of before.
Yeah.
And leveraging the power of VR. Jury's still out. We're getting our first two Pilot Training Next students in an upcoming class. So they're going straight from the T6, skipping T38s completely, and coming to Fly Strike Eagles. They've already done it in the F-16 and the F-35 and a couple other places with varying degree of success. I can't speak for them, but we'll see when we get our students here and how it goes for them. But
yeah,
it's pretty interesting things that the changes that are coming down just to solve or help solve the pilot training pipeline problem that we have.
Okay. Yeah. Well, if anybody has questions about the NJET process, either applying for it or what the experience is like going through NJET, and you know what it's like living in beautiful Wichita Falls, Texas.
Again, there's worse places.
you can reach out to Clark. We'll include his contact information at the end of the show and in the show notes. And you can also engage the podcast through our normal outlets. Well, good. Let's spend some time talking about the 11 Foxtrot AFSC specifically.
Okay, yeah.
So that is your AFSC.
Yep.
What's your actual like shred out?
So I'm a Q11F3G.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay. What do all those things mean?
So the prefixes denote different qualifications.
Okay.
So if you see a K prefix, that's an instructor pilot.
Okay.
Or WISO. So the WISO side is the 12F. Strike Eagle, it's a two cockpit aircraft. So we fly with weapon system officers, and that's a whole different pipeline. So
right.
Not technically pilots, but we consider them fighter pilots with us, their air crew. So anyway, between both of us, the K is going to be your instructor. And then if you're a W prefix, that means you went to weapon school.
Mm-hmm.
And then a Q prefix is an evaluator. So
a
CFE, we call them. So evaluator, pilot, or WISO. So Q, that's that part. And then the 3G is the Strike Eagle. So the F denotes your fighter pilot. So 11F, and then the 3G is where you find your aircraft that you fly.
Okay. But your core AFSC is the 11F, mm-hmm. the fighter pilot. Explain to us, why do we have fighter pilots?
Yeah. Well, Elon Musk, I don't think, wants them anymore.
Right?
You know? Yeah, so you know we've existed since the dawn of the Air Force, back in the P-51 type days, and
well, even the dawn of manned flight. You know, getting in a cockpit carrying a pistol.
Yeah, you're not wrong. You know, the Red Barons of the day, and so you know, fighter pilots were very unique people, I think, and
still are.
Yes. And there's a breadth of us. The stereotype, obviously, is the type A type of guy who potentially is crass and sarcastic.
The Mavericks of the world.
Yeah, and, you know, there is some legitimacy to that, I'd say so. But there's the piece that is very important for us is we're very much critical thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And we find problems easily. We usually find solutions in a way that we want to do it our way.
Mm-hmm.
And then the communication of the problem or solution is probably where we lack the tact, especially with outside agencies. The way we treat each other is with respect, but we expect a high level of competency. And with that, we will also tell you when you're wrong as far as each other.
Sure.
Our debriefs are very unique. We say that rank comes off the debrief. So I don't care if you're an 05 or an 01, I'll treat you the same. So when we find an error, I'm going to identify the error, prove it to you, and then figure out if that was a decision, an execution error or a perception error, and then come back and instruct you appropriately. So when we then take that out of the debrief and we now insert it into the real world, that's probably where then that's where the interaction comes with most people in the Air Force. Some people have issues with that, and that's right. Okay. I think that as a community, we need to learn to work together. And our way is not always the right way, and there's reasons why people might do it differently. And so I think as a community, people usually can understand when things are logical.
Mm-hmm.
But then it comes to a point when it's like, well, what you're saying right now doesn't make sense. That's when it probably strikes a chord with us and some of the stereotypes come out, I'd say. So I think the fighter pilots in general, though, there's a whole swath of them where you might have, I've met very shy, you know, introspective type people who might not be that type A person, but yeah. Can still go out and execute very well. So the job itself is, I'd say, a high level of knowledge is required. The good thing is that we teach it in a way that you can learn it. Yeah. I'd say most people can learn to become fighter pilots. It's not something that is in 100% nature. You know, you do have an aspect of having to conform a little bit and have to change, not to compromise values or anything, but in order to become successful, I'd say.
Yeah, the Air Force has its own way of flying.
Right.
And the Air Force needs you to conform to that particular way of flying in order to achieve our mission, right?
Yeah. And what's interesting that I'm seeing now is creativity is still required. With increasing in technology, especially in our adversaries, it requires creativity to defeat that threat. And coming up with new ways to crack the nut is important. And you know that's why we send people to weapons school.
Yeah.
So that they can learn to even be better critical thinkers and solve these pretty complex problems that we're going to be dealing with, that the NDS, the National Defense Strategy, kind of requires us to tackle. So, So it is going to be interesting in the next, you know, 5 to 20 years as our technology is, we're pretty much where we're at right now. We do have improvements coming, but we see a larger increase in improvements, you know, from our near peer adversaries. So, yeah, that's kind of us in a nutshell. I wouldn't say I probably did a really great job of explaining the fighter pilots, but what I'll say is we're not mean. We're not. We don't hate you. We actually really appreciate hard work. And you know, I've been flying up here at Hill Air Force Base on a TDY, and I was dropping this 5,000-pound weapon 2 days ago, and it requires a large amount of mission planning. It's a bunker buster type weapon developed back in, it's called a GBU-28, developed back in for the Gulf War. And there's some very unique things about it that I've never dealt with. And one of them requires the pressure altitude of the target area.
Okay.
And because of that, I now need to work specifically with our weather shop. And he needs to give me a very accurate, you know, assessment of what the pressure altitude is going to be. And so we brought our young airman out here, and I go to him, I'm like, hey man, don't screw this up or else, you know, we're going to miss the target. And, you know, he gave us the pressure altitude. We went out, we flew it, we dropped the bomb, came back and it hit perfectly. Came back and I, you know, gave him a big high five and like, hey dude, because of you, we hit the target. Like you did your job today. And you brought the mission home.
Yeah.
And so that kind of stuff is, it's important to come back and really realize where we all play a piece in the mission. If you don't know where you play the piece in your mission, then you need to go out and figure that out.
Right.
Because it's super important. When I was deployed, we had both fighters and tankers on base.
Yeah.
I can't believe this. And one of the airmen working at the chow hall asked me, why do we have these tanker aircraft here? And I was like, well, we're at war, you know? Like, oh, so are they the ones that bring in the gas for the generators? You're just like, Yes, they are. You know,
yes, for the air power generator.
That's right. So that you have air conditioning and you can go play your Fortnite, you know? So it's so important, though, to realize where you play the part in the mission. Because if you don't, I would have a hard time probably maintaining motivation if I didn't know that what I was doing it was important. And it is for all of us. It is. It's very important what we do.
Yeah. So you are specifically in the F-15E, the Strike Eagle. We don't need to get into the specifics of that particular airframe, but what is your role as the pilot in flying the F-15E, also knowing that you've got a WISO in the back seat that you know, is responsible for the actual deployment of the weapons? Like, what is that relationship like? What is your role in supporting combatant commanders, providing those capabilities in the F-15E?
Yeah, well, it's a multi-role aircraft. So it came off of the F-15A and C, so the C model is how it's usually referred to now. And they're an air-to-air only aircraft. So the Air Force discovered, hey, this is a really good airplane. What if we put some more gas on it, strap some bombs on it, and see how good it is? And so they kind of pivoted from the C model into the Strike Eagle. And so because of that, we are self-support, and our main mission is usually air interdiction.
Okay.
So AI is how it's referred, or we call it SAT. And so with AI missions, sometimes you're self-support. Sometimes you might have offensive counter air as well, i.e. from Raptors or C models or F-35s or whatnot. So we'll fight our way into a target, we'll drop our bombs, and then we'll fight our way out. So we carry missiles, usually AMRAAMs and Sidewinder missiles, so 9 Mikes or 9 Xs. And we're able, you know, we train for air-to-air fighting as well.
Yeah.
So as the pilot, I'll just talk single ship more than anything, and then I can talk flight leadership in a minute. But as a pilot, it's my job to fly the aircraft and get us safely to and from the target.
Yeah.
With that in mind, I usually will run the air-to-air radar and more or less conduct the air-to-air fight from the front seat.
Okay.
When it gets into the air-to-ground realm, that is mostly the WISO. He or she is in charge of the bombs, making sure that they're healthy, finding the targets, and then getting the system set up so that we can drop the bombs on the right target. We both have a vote. So if I see something jacked up, I don't press the button.
Right.
If he or she sees something jacked up, they don't tell me to release the weapon. So I don't press the button until they are like, you're clear to release. And so we're able to, that's kind of our crew coordination to make sure that we are on the same page. With that in mind, though, there's times when, you know, the fog of war happens, I'm fighting air to air, I'm shooting missiles, and he tells me to drop the bomb right away. I trust him. I'm going to press the button, and we're going to keep going at our fight here. It's pretty cool to have two really good, competent people in the aircraft working mm-hmm. together for the same mission. It can be very hampering, is that the right word, when you don't have a competent either front seater or back seater. It can be a drain on your situational awareness, and it's difficult to fight through.
Yeah.
So in the FTU where I teach, I fly with student WISOs a lot, so it's mostly me with, you know, inexperienced WISOs and just teaching them how to be better WISOs. And when I do fly with an instructor or somebody who's really good at being a WISO, it's a game changer.
Yeah.
It makes everything so much easier. I'm able to spend my time on my side of the house more and be a better pilot for it.
Yeah. So your primary role, at least in the F-15E, is, like you said, you fight your way in. You don't need anybody to do that for you. You have the capability of doing the air-to-air fight. You can deliver weapons, deliver effects on the ground, you know, either doing an interdiction mission or close air support. You have both of those capabilities, and then you have the ability to escort yourself back to the base.
That's right. Yep. And air interdiction is kind of our, you know, our bread and butter, but what we've been doing the last 20 years is more close air support.
Yeah.
You know?
And when was the last time that there was an actual, like, dogfight?
That's been a while.
Yeah. So
now,
still a mission that you train to, but not something that you are going to see in an operational deployment very often.
Yeah. And even then, like, if when we go to Red Flag and we practice interdiction missions, usually doesn't end up being in dogfighting. We're usually killing the red air at range, beyond visual range. So the day that I need to go and actually turn with the flanker is a bad day.
Yeah, it's means that something has seriously gone wrong.
Yeah, and quite frankly, our aircraft probably won't perform extremely well comparatively, and I'll probably be out of missiles by the time I'm merging because I've already shot them all at the bad guy. So,
and let's be honest, we would prefer to eliminate the target from a distance. We want to get rid of them before they can get close enough to
attack us. You know, it's not only air threats. There's a lot of surface to air threats as well. That again, technology is improving substantially, and they're able to be a distraction to us at a much larger range than ever before. So it's another piece of the puzzle that we have to crack. And again, that's why, being a fighter pilot, you have to have this knowledge of all of these threats to be able to safely execute your mission.
Yeah. And which again is, you mentioned earlier, why the weapons school exists, why you send pilots to go through that particular training.
Yeah.
And then they bring that expertise back to the squadron.
Absolutely. They are the key and the core kind of instructor. They're the instructor of all instructors, if you will. And it's their job to make sure that we're ready for the fight.
Awesome. So you kind of already mentioned the pilot-wizzo relationship. You as well touched on in your story about that airman. Was it a weather technician?
Yeah. Yep.
It wasn't a weather officer?
Nope.
Okay. Maybe talk a little bit more about that pilot-wizzo relationship or any other AFSCs, especially officer AFSCs that a fighter pilot is typically going to work with.
So on a daily basis, my normal job, I'll work with intelligence officers, so intel guys. We usually have at least one intel officer in the squadron, and then he or she has two or three enlisted intel as well. And they help us mission plan. They help us develop different training scenarios in order to accurately replicate the threat that we're trying to fight that day. So they're a key person in our fight. We deal with aircrew flight equipment. Those are all enlisted folks as well. They take care of all of our harnesses, G-suits, helmets, make sure that we are safe out there. Obviously, if I ever eject, that is probably the most important person in the chain, making sure that all of my my flight equipment work properly in order to save my life that day. So,
and thankfully, you have not had to
reach
out yet.
Luckily not. My back probably couldn't really sustain that very well. So AFE is important. We deal with, they're called One Charlie Oscars, and they are in charge of all of our flight records. And they work to make sure that we have all of our currencies up to date and that we are, again, safe in flying that day. We deal with maintenance. Man, those guys are probably the most important piece of the puzzle here.
Yeah.
I can be the best fighter pilot in the world, but if I don't have a good aircraft that day.
Well, you are the best fighter pilot in the world, right?
Again, I could be trying to get rid of these stereotypes, Colin. You're throwing them right back at me. So the maintenance folks, man, they're the ones that are busting their butt every day, every night, working out in the heat, out in the cold to make sure that the jets are ready. And the F-15E is not a new aircraft.
Right.
It's shown its age. And as I continue through it, in the last 8 years, I've seen it continue to be more and more difficult for these guys. So I applaud their work every day. Again, maintenance officers are there. Doesn't mean that they're not the technical experts there, right? That's the 7-level and 5-level type enlisted folks that know the jet. They might know the engine in and out. They might know the hydraulic system or whatever system they work on. So the officer side is more of a management side on that house,
right?
Making sure that I put the right people at the right aircraft to fix them, to make sure that they're ready for the next flying sorties. So,
yeah. But what is your relationship with the maintenance officer?
There's not much there at my level.
Okay.
It is more at a director of operations level. We'll deal with the captain, usually maintenance officer of a AMU. Now, the maintenance officer works hand in hand with the pro supervisor, so the lead NCOICs, to make sure that, they are directing their people.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a traditional, if what you think of like a one officer, a lead NCOIC, a couple other, senior NCOs, that then lead the masses of junior enlisted and sometimes NCOs to get the job done.
Yeah.
So a lot of management and leadership goes into those maintenance officers. And, you know, there's good ones and bad ones. And, you know,
sure.
The current one we have up here at Hill, she was an acquisitions officer. And a couple people fell out. They threw her in, and she's crushing it. She's doing very well. And so it's just core leadership principles that can get these guys through the job. So, again, I'd say the ROTC aspect is probably a good carryover into that type of career field for sure.
Yeah, okay. What about, like, flight medicine and the flight doc?
Yeah, so flight doc is, we consider them part of the squadron as well. You know, they wear flight suits. They wear all of our patches. They fly with us. We're a two-seat aircraft, so we can fly with flight docs often. They're definitely an interesting part of the chain because when I'm sick or hurt, it is, you know, especially as an instructor, I need to get back to flying as soon as possible,
right?
Because we don't have enough of us, you know? So, they do their best to get us to that spot. And they also will be the ones that, you know, call timeout when it's something's not right. And so we have to lean on their expertise for that. And they have kind of the yellow flag that they'll throw out sometimes, you know, for right or for wrong. Sometimes there's a bad relationship with that, but, it's important to keep our health there. And as I'm getting older in flying, I'm now understanding why it's so important to maintain my health. It's way more important than flying to me, is just to not be a 32-year-old with a broken back, is how I feel. But so they also have technicians that they work with, med techs. And again, both of those groups keep us flying, which is important. And then the last, probably, well, maybe not the last, but another important side of the house is the airfield ops people.
Okay, yep.
Making sure the runways are okay. Everything's, you know, from the civil engineering side of the house, but also like the cable configuration, taxiways and all that stuff. And then bird mitigation, making sure that, you know, those stupid birds cause so much damage to
right.
to our aircraft. So getting rid of those things. And then the air traffic controllers, both in the tower and the RAPCONs. Usually there's probably about two officers on base that run, you know, all those folks. And then you have more types of those, Intel and one COs that are at the OSS, at every base. So that's in a nutshell. Then you have the people that we don't interact with on a daily basis, you know, the finance guys, the personnelists, that we try to stay away from.
Yeah, that you're only interacting with them
when there's a problem.
When there's a problem.
Yeah. But again, you know, like when they do, I applaud those that do a good job, that pick up the phone when we come back from deployment, that they're there to help us process all the travel vouchers and whatnot. Again, just know that you're part of the missions is the important part.
Yeah. In a similar vein, you know, if you're interacting with security forces, you know, something probably went wrong.
Yeah, but you know what's cool? So we're doing a couple things at Seymour Johnson that's developing what's called multifunctional airmen, where we're taking Strike Eagles, we're rapidly deploying them to austere locations, and we're having people that don't normally, you know, refuel or rearm with weapons the aircraft, i.e. security forces and whatnot, actually learning those jobs and performing them. And again, they are loving it, you know, and we're also giving weapons to maintenance officers so they can clear a landing zone, you know, and not just officers, but maintenance personnel and help secure a location so that a Strike Eagle could come in. Like those are the things that help people really realize that they're part of the mission and you know, that you can play a part that's not maybe your traditional sense. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. But the bottom line, most important relationship for you as a fighter pilot is, especially in the Strike Eagle, is you and your...
And the WISO.
And your WISO.
Yeah, I'd say so. Absolutely. And what's cool, though, is we train everyone the same, but you all have your characteristics that you might be better or worse at. And when we deploy, we traditionally will... You'll be hard crew for a time. So you'll spend a lot of time with the same WISO, getting to know them and getting to know their strengths and weaknesses and being able to complement each other. But you're right. You know, it's a very unique thing to have a WISO. You know, there's not many aircraft that still have WISOs. And, you know, it's a misunderstood group too. Right. You know, the Air Force in general doesn't do a great job of supporting them, even though they are just as important to the Strike Eagle as the pilot is, if not sometimes more important. So there's a lot of what we call WISO haters out there. And if you find yourself, you know, hating on a WISO, I will protect them, you know, and we do stand up for each other. But they hold their own, you know, like they,
and you are an intimidating individual. You know,
I bet
I'd be afraid to meet you.
Yeah, real intimidating
in a bar.
So, yeah, that's, WISOs are for me, I think the coolest part of the Strike Eagle and the probably the most misunderstood, you know, part. People say, "Oh, you're less of a fighter pilot because you have to fly with the, you know, they call them a navigator," but it's not like that. Yeah, it's totally different.
Yeah, maybe the better way to think of it is that you're a better fighter pilot because you have that person there in the back seat.
Yeah, I mean, there's two brains, four eyeballs looking at all the sensors and making the right decision. So, again, it can be a tool, but it could also be a drag, just depending on on the competency of each other.
Yeah, so let's talk about that operational relationship, especially in the deployed environment. Well, first of all, let's talk about deployments to begin with. You know, what's it like being a fighter pilot, being deployed, being moved out of ACC and putting under the command of a combatant commander, being used for actual operational effects? What's that all like?
So unlike most career fields, we deploy as a squadron. So the entire squadron will pack up and move together.
Yeah.
Our squadron commander becomes the expeditionary squadron commander at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And he falls under now kind of two chains of command. There's still a at-home presence, and you know, because he's still your commander back home, i.e. the operations group commander or the wing commander. But you now have a new wing commander and a new, potentially new operations group commander as well. And now there is, you know, an order to fly what's called the Air Tasking Order, the ATO. And the ATO is developed every day. And it basically, what assets are we using where in the AOR and where you're getting your fuel, what mission set you're going to be doing, whether it's defensive counter air, whether it's close air support, whether you're doing a deliberate target strike. All that is defined in the ATO, and that is produced over in at the CAOC, Combined Air Operations Center.
Mm-hmm.
So with that in mind, you're now not training anymore. So that's the biggest thing. We're not developing training sessions and going out and flying and practicing. And so the briefs are shorter. The debriefs are shorter, usually, and the flights are longer, typically.
You know,
my average flight normally is about an hour and a half, and deployed it was around 8 hours to potentially up to 12 hours is my longest one. So, and a lot of that was driving from where we were located. But some of it is because of the mission required it. And we needed to stay overhead to protect those on the ground or to stay looking for the adversary that we were fighting that day.
Right.
So deployed life though is definitely different. You're away from your family and, luckily, the technology is great. You know, you can FaceTime. There's internet. That's good.
In most places, usually if an F-15 has showed up at a location, there's probably internet.
There's probably internet, yeah. I like to say I don't go anywhere if I don't get Hilton points, but that's not quite the case with deployments. Usually you're bunked up. You know, I had two roommates, actually. And as a lieutenant, that's where I deployed. My main job was to fly. And that was about it, you know. So I flew about 3 times a week. And then the other days I'd go into the squadron. I was a scheduler at the time, so I had a separate duty. We should probably talk on that a little bit. But when we're not flying, what are we doing? But so I did scheduling and then, you know, worked out and stayed healthy. Got off base a couple times to see the town. But most of the job, especially back in 2016 when I was there, that it was the height of OIR versus now it's a little bit slower.
Right.
So, you know, employed a lot of weapons and, you know, it was awesome. It was definitely, it's kind of like the fireman wants to go to the fire. That's where we wanted to be at the time. And it was a great experience.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk about some of those non-flying duties, even when deployed, things that you might be involved in.
Yeah, so you always have something that you're in charge of or this, that you have to do when you're not flying. It would be great if all I did was just go to work, flew, and then came home, and that was it. But there's a lot of different things that go on to produce, you know, a squadron. So there's safety officers so that when there is an accident or a mishap or even just a part fails in the aircraft and you have to come home early, you have to potentially do an investigation on those types of events. So that requires, TDYs and training in order to become a safety officer. There are schedulers. Usually now that is contracted out, which is a big help for us.
Oh, good.
But there usually is at least one green bag where that's in scheduling that can potentially answer some questions. But, man, that's a full-time job, making the schedule for the following day and the rest of the week and then the following week as well. And
yeah,
making sure that everybody gets their training requirements and their upgrades and all that stuff. So with that, the training, there's a training officer typically, and it's their job to, again, manage the syllabi and make sure that the different flight lead upgrades and tier one, tier two WISOs, which is essentially a flight lead upgrade for WISOs, that they're executing it properly. They're not getting deviations and making sure that everyone's flying the right number of flights a month to maintain their readiness. Additionally, there's mobility. So anytime we go TDY or we go deploy, they're in charge of all of our deployment folders and making sure we have all the training, the ground training stuff, and packing up, like working with LRS and packing up the different equipment and all that stuff. So that's a pretty heavy job. There's stand eval, so standardization and evaluation. So they're in charge of all of our check rides, making sure that we are all current and that we stay current. And then if there's any, checklist issues or problems with maybe procedures that might have arisen, then they can work with the other stand eval programs on base to make sure that those are all correct. We have back in the vault. So most of our work that we do is usually classified. So we do a lot of stuff in a vault.
Yeah.
So a secure environment. And so back there, we usually have, depends on where you're at, but they work all the computer systems back in the back there, making sure that those are all working and that we have all of our media and all of our maps and whatnot. And then additionally, the weapons officers usually work back there as well, and they work with the intel people to produce the right training. Flight commanders, so we usually have 3 to 4 flight commanders, and everyone usually falls under a flight commander, especially like the young lieutenants and captains.
Yeah.
And that's a traditional leadership job, but obviously you're also leading in a flying type perspective. That is about it for in the squadron. Then there's, we call them attached guys. So you might fly, like I'm actually attached. I fly with the 334th Fighter Squadron, but I'm actually in the 4th Training Squadron. And,
yeah.
So I have my own ground duties, and man, there's a smattering of what you could be doing for that. But you still fly with a fighter squadron.
Obviously, because you have to stay current. You have to maintain your own particular training.
Yeah, my core duty is to fly and instruct. But I might have some other jobs, that I do on the side.
Yeah. So. Okay. So back on the deployment, can you talk to some of the stresses or the things that are difficult or some of the things that are wonderful about being deployed and actually doing the thing that you've been training for all this time?
Yeah. So I think the difficulty is, there's the family separation.
Sure.
6 months is a long time. And, you're missing birthdays and births potentially and all that stuff. Obviously, leadership comes into play there. And I think leadership at least my leadership has done a really great job of mitigating some of those effects. In fact, when we were deployed, the policy there was that family could come out and actually see us. So I spent, 5 days with my wife and daughter in Dubai, during my deployment. And that was awesome. It was pretty cool to do the mission one day and then seeing my daughter the next day, it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then going right back to it. So that was very unique for where we were at.
Right. Yeah, definitely not going to be the case for all deployments.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect that for sure, but take advantage of it when it's there.
Yeah.
Additionally, you know, the safety is a concern. About 3 months before I deployed was when the Jordanian pilot was, put in a cage and burned. And it was pretty eye-opening, you know, to see how real it could be if I ever did eject. So that was a concern for probably more my mom than anyone.
Right.
So it was interesting to fly every day, but you know, we train for it. This is what we do, and we have confidence in ourselves, and you know, and then when issues arise, we're going to deal with them and, in a level, calm way so that we can get back home safely. So the biggest threat out there for us was, an aircraft failure more than anything, to be honest. From the ISIS perspective, they didn't really have too much that they could reach out and get us at the altitudes we were flying at. So it was more of a concern if an aircraft had a catastrophic issue. But again, we're two engines, luckily, so we can limp home if we need to, or limp to another base in order to safely land, which we had to do a couple times, but nobody got hurt, which is good. And that's probably the harder parts. The great parts is obviously executing the mission. And OIR was fascinating to me. The complexities of Syria at the time and now really were huge. Seeing the Kurds and what they do and watching them on a daily basis fight, it was impressive. Yeah. And you could literally look out, and I wasn't in World War I, but I could look out and see the trenches, if you will, or you see the berms and see where the lines were. And it was amazing to see. You knew that past that line was where ISIS was. And when the Kurds would take another city, they would just rebuild the berm and keep moving the wall, if you will, which was amazing to watch.
Yeah.
And, one of the more kind of eye opening things to me was, we were over Syria and, had our target pod out, which our target pod's pretty good. It's not like an RPA. It's not full color, high fidelity, but you know, I can see an adult versus a child pretty well, you know, at pretty far distances. Can't really see if that adult's carrying a weapon or anything that an RPA could. So we have to work together on some of those things to identify who the bad guys are. But, you know, good guys carry guns too, you know, so that's not a give all for that. But one time we were over Syria and I had our target pod out over this home, and the JTAC told us that it looked like that they were bringing out a barrel of some sort. And so we were watching them, and sure enough, there's this big tube that comes out of this house, you know, like, okay, all right, you know, this might be something we could engage in. And they strap it on top of a car and they keep loading stuff into this car. And eventually they get in the car, and then two little kids run out and get in the car as well, and they start driving away. And I don't know exactly what they were packing, but I want to say that it was like their family rug, you know, and they were packing up their stuff and leaving, you know, Syria as the tragedy of Syria was, that it just displaced millions of people.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, obviously we didn't get anywhere close to employing, but it was eye-opening to me to see families just ripped apart and ripped out of their homes. And, you know, we put a lot of weapons into buildings that were probably people's homes at one point. And hopefully one day they come back, but they're going to come back to a very different Syria. And it's pretty, eye-opening for that. And so, you know, we had some friends that dealt with some issues, PTSD-type issues.
Yeah.
Luckily, we're very displaced away from the threats. It's not close hand-to-hand combat, you know, but it can definitely get to you and affect people in ways that you might not expect. I had some interesting things coming back from deployment. We went to Rome and pre-corona.
And, yeah.
I remember we were at the Colosseum, and all of a sudden I heard a ton of sirens, and then there was just a mass of people sprinting past us. And it was just reflexes. I just grabbed my kid and I just picked her up and I started running. And it was such a weird, you know, like, why am I doing this? You know? at that same trip, we went to a mall, and this was shortly after we got back, so my emotions were probably a little bit higher, but we went to this mall, and, you know, my wife went that way with our daughter, and I went this way, and I go to look for him, and I couldn't find him for 45 minutes, and I don't know why, but I started bawling, you know, and it was pretty amazing to me, like, why am I, like, they're clearly okay, you know, but it was definitely just a, it was just emotions were different, you know, and just worked through it, but, you know, some people can't just work through it, and right. requires, you know, mental health to really fix a lot of those things. So luckily, I don't think we don't have too much of those issues, but the help is there, and I encourage those that do have those to reach out and sing up and talk to your commander, and don't be afraid to say something. I think that's the biggest thing, is when you're broken, whether it's mentally or physically, it's more important to be fixed than it is to worry about if you're going to fly more or not, you know? So,
yeah. And it hits on kind of like what you were talking about before, that, you know, the thing that's going to help or hinder, you know, the operational mission the most is your capability, your competency within the aircraft. And if you're not 100%, if you're not, you know, able to, you know, fully engage in the mission there, you're not helping. You yep. are a drag on your wingman, the WISO, or the other pilot, and you're making it harder for the Air Force to actually get its job done. And I'm thank you for touching on the mental health aspect of it. I'm really glad that you got to that. And that was something that if you didn't get to it, I was going to ask about, because I imagine, you know, it can be pretty stressful to have to release that ordinance, knowing that it is going to, you know, impact some lives.
Absolutely.
For good and for bad, yeah. Right?
You're absolutely right. And if you aren't ready, then I don't want you in the cockpit. I'd rather we take a knee and not even go fly. We do an operational risk assessment every day before we fly, and we make sure that we have, you know, that we're competent, that we had enough sleep the night before. What's the weather out there? How complex is the mission? Did it all of a sudden change at the brief? And all that kind of goes into a risk management type scenario that we have to make a call
yeah.
on.
And also, like, how did that FaceTime call go with your family?
Yeah, absolutely. Because right.
that's going to impact it, right?
It really will. Yeah, it really will. Both, you know, at home and while you're, you know, if you have home issues, you know, like, you got to be able to raise your hand sometimes and say, yeah, I'm not ready today. And I respect those that do that.
Yeah.
You know, you might get razzed on a little bit, and rightfully so, you know, like, how about you go to bed early, you know, but I would rather you raise your hand and say, I don't have enough sleep today, than us to go out and have a Class A mishap because you were tired.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. Your life, the life of your wingmen and jeopardizing the Air Force mission is just not worth it
at all.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially since you got a guy 6 feet behind you that he doesn't have a vote, you know? So, I mean, he does, but it's not right to do that to somebody. So you gotta make the right assessment.
Absolutely. Well, good. All right. Well, glad that we got through those topics, because those are things that we need to highlight more and more, that mental health issues are real and that there's nothing wrong with them. And more importantly, if and when they do arise, there are resources available to you to help you get that kind of thing taken care of.
Yeah, and it's not just for us either. You know, our family, it's very important for them to be involved, you know. Heck, you know, the PTSD is not just for, you know, the fighters, the people that go out and operate. It's for everybody. And, you know, our spouses potentially have a lot of, you know, those postpartum is a real thing. And,
right.
and again, if your home isn't right, then you're not right. And it's going to affect the mission for sure. Yeah, those resources are definitely out there, and I encourage all to utilize them for sure.
Awesome. Well, thanks for opening up on that and shedding some light for it. All right. So let's go back and talk about, we kind of touched on it in our discussion about ROTC not being sufficient to prepare you for what you do as a fighter pilot. So let's talk about what you have done to make sure that you continually develop as an officer, as a competent technician of your craft, how have you continued to grow or to at least address some of the gaps in your training that ROTC left you with?
So I think taking that on yourself is important, you know, whether that's, reading books, you know, getting into leadership books or getting into, you know, business books are typically leader based as well. I personally, I'm pretty into personal finance, and, you know, mentoring other people with that kind of stuff, I think is a very important tool, for not only, you know, personal growth, but also for other people. And then getting out of your comfort zone, and getting out of the squadron to be able to tackle problems with other agencies is huge, you know? Traditionally, you won't find us at the CGOC, you know, and I think we're looked down upon it. And, you know, I can see both sides of the coin on that one.
Yeah.
I don't participate, but I understand why people would be mad at me for not. I understand. I do. But it is important to build relationships, and it is because the day that your lieutenant has finance issues, if that's the first day you're meeting the finance officer, you know, it'll probably be okay. They're going to do their job too, but wouldn't it be better if you had a good relationship with them, you know, and like, hey, Steve, can you really help me out with this, man? You know, like, we don't have much time, you know, can you help? And they could take it from there. So building tact and being able to speak intelligently to other people is important, you know? And so, when those problems arise, cause they do in every squadron, instead of just like letting the problem set there, pick it up and go do it, you know, and figure it out. And, you know, you don't need to do it for your gratification of your OPR. Go out there and fix it so that the bro coming behind you doesn't have to deal with that problem himself, you know?
Yeah.
So
that's good. I have to ask the question, how do you feel about the cliche, you're an officer first and a pilot second?
It's a unique path, you know, and unique as in different from the world, but it's very common for, you know, an officer to be a pilot. Like, how many people probably thought you were a pilot when you're this?
All of them.
Yeah, yeah, you know. yeah, there you have it. Oh, you're in the Air Force. Oh, you a pilot?
Well, on that note, why do you think it is that we have our pilots be officers?
So part of it is a legality. When you take a life, it is on the order of an officer. And even in the Army, they're not going to, well, I'm not Army, so forgive me, Army people. But you
they
know,
don't listen to this podcast. So.
Under someone, like they're going to have their ROE dictated to them from an officer somewhere, you know, in their chain of command. And same goes to show in a Navy, I would assume. I don't know too much about Navy, you know, fires, but all their pilots are officers as well. There are technical aspects that I think traditionally is a reason why, hey, you know, having a degree is important because it, you know, you at least went through a very difficult thing in order to get there, and a little bit of proving that you're up for the task. But it doesn't mean that those that don't have degrees can't do our job. You know, I think physically people, you know, enlisted could definitely do our job if you put enough training in them, you know. Interestingly, the pilot training next, they actually took a couple enlisted and put them, you know, 18-year-olds and put them in the pilot training next to see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't think it's going to solve the pilot training thing, but it more of a you know, experiment to see if somebody, you know, what age is required or is the degree even required to do our job. I'd venture to say no. I don't think it is, you know, especially since I haven't specifically used my degree since getting in the Air Force. But the aspects of working hard and studying and dedication, I think those carry over very well.
Okay. Well, good. Well, let's start to wrap things up a little bit. You alluded to the fact that you've got 2.5 years or so left. What's next for you? Are you going to be in it for the long haul? Are you going to punch out and join the airlines? Or what do you envision for yourself over the next few years?
One assignment at a time, you know. So I'm actually applying for the Thunderbirds this year.
Awesome.
So this is my fourth year applying.
You know, they fly a single engine jet,
that's
right?
That's right, yeah. It's If you're listening, it's a great aircraft. Yeah. No, it's I'm excited for it, for what's to come if that pans out, and if not that, then flying the Strike Eagle somewhere probably, or potentially transitioning to the F-35, flying up here at Hill ideally. I'd love to get out west, whether that's Mountain Home, Boise, or out here.
Yeah,
it's definitely for our family, and then who knows after that? At that point, you know, I'll be pinning on Major next year sometime, and then it'll be, you know, the decision if school is an opportunity for me, whether you take that and go or get out. So there's a lot of opportunities for pilots for sure. We are in demand worldwide, for sure. So if you have the skill, it can be very useful and lucrative for you, and it's not that hard, you know. So it's a good transition if that is the case. Guard and reserve opportunities are out there. There's a lot of flying opportunities in those aspects, that if you want a little bit more control over your life and not having to move whenever the Air Force wants, but more when you want, you know, transitioning to the Guard and reserve is a great way to do that.
Well, good. Well, we're excited to see what happens for you and wherever you end up. Keep us updated.
Absolutely.
And also so that those who listen to this podcast and hear this episode can get in touch with you, maybe cross paths, get some mentorship, get some instruction from the infamous Slider.
Yeah, I absolutely encourage everyone. We'll throw my email out there, but I encourage you to continue listening to this podcast and gaining information, if nothing else. You know, this might not be the right thing for you, and that's okay. You know, we definitely need help elsewhere. Even if the service is not right for you, that's okay too.
Yeah.
But going out and serving and doing something bigger than yourself is important.
Good. Well, one final question for you, Slider.
Yeah.
Well, what does it mean to be an officer?
For me, to be an officer is to be not only a leader, but also somebody who people want to follow. And the difference to me is the idea that I not only care about getting the job done, but I also care about those around me and making sure that everyone is safe and happy and progressing in life.
Awesome. Love it. Well, thank you, Slider. Clark, appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. Colin, thanks so much for what a great interview that was. So many things that I really want to talk about. I think what I want to kick off the discussion here is probably my favorite story from your interview. Was when he went and found that weather airman who had given him a brief that allowed them to have mission success. This reminded me of an experience that I had when I was deployed to Alhudeid Air Base. I was working at the Combined Air Operations Center. We were planning and executing the global war against ISIS and kind of wrapping things up, well, the first time in Afghanistan as we transitioned away from combat operations to resolute support. And that's when ISIS was a thing, and we were dropping bombs every day in Iraq and Syria, and it was hard work, long hours, you know, crazy work. And I remember some of the captains, I was a lieutenant at the time, they had arranged with some of the B-1 drivers for us to be present on the airfield for a B-1 takeoff. Now, for those of you who don't know, a B-1 takes off an afterburner, and it is a glorious sight to behold. Seeing those four trash cans just putting out hurt on the air around, it was fantastic. Anyway, so we get in the van, we drive to the flight line, we check in with security forces, do the FOD, the whole thing, right? And then we get there, and you can't really see the aircraft because it's kind of a long ways away. But boy, you can hear it. And then it just roars right over our van. The whole van's rocking back and forth. And this thing's going off to drop bombs on the enemy. Man, I rode that high for like a month. And that was a simple act that some folks did to connect me and what I was doing to the mission.
Right.
And simple acts can go a really long way. All it took was them talking to a couple of people and then getting the van, you know, so not cosmic. They didn't have to get clearances or anything really hard, but just little things. You know, talk to the guys that clean off all the arming loops on an aircraft. Hey, those arming loops are going in the trash. Can I bring some of those to my buddies? And you just hand them out. Hey, this bomb was dropped over Syria and it armed a weapon that was dropped on the enemy. Like, those are going to be treasured little pieces of aluminum garbage that they're going to carry around forever. And you can do that. Not can, you better. You should. You should be looking out for your folks that have their head in the computer every day and are working hard and sometimes might be questioning, why does this matter? How am I connecting this to success? I think that's one of our most important responsibilities. And those who do it well, their people will get in line to do what they need them to do.
Yeah. I'm going to butcher the saying, but something along the lines of where there is no vision, the people perish, right? And it's your responsibility as a leader, as an officer, to provide that vision and help your airmen, help your people understand how it is that they are making the mission happen, highlighting their efforts and connecting them to the bigger picture. Because just as you're saying, they're likely going to be head down, face stuck in a computer, clicking away on those CBTs that they're like, this does nothing for me. I thought I was joining the military, not just this life-sucking organization that is, you know, destroying all the joy in my life. But if you can help them see how what they are doing is enabling the mission, that's huge. That's everything, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we could keep pulling this thread. Well, how are you going to be able to do that? Well, you kind of have to know people. Maybe you should go to the CGO council on your installation. Maybe you should talk to other people. Maybe you should go to formal functions. I mean, the list goes on. This could be arranging for an incentive ride for your Airman of the Year. This could be any number of things. Reach out, you know, but you have to build a network. You have to. So there's stuff you have to do. It's not something you can just pull out of your hat at a moment's notice. It needs to be part of your milieu of what you do as an officer. You reach out, you connect to people, you understand connections, you maintain friendships so that when the time comes, you can take the mission to your airmen so that they can feel and understand and appreciate what it is and how important they are. Because believe me, if everyone had enough manning, which that's never going to happen, but what I'm getting at is everyone really matters.
Right.
Because if you don't, the mission's not going to happen. So yeah, connecting your airmen to the mission, you really got to do that for them.
Awesome. One of the things that I wanted to highlight from Slider's interview was the discussion that we had about Air Force ROTC specifically, since that was the context that both Slider and I came out of. The idea that Air Force ROTC does not prepare our officers, specifically our pilot candidates, for flying training. What do you think is going on there, Reed?
I think my first thought on that is, what percentage of Air Force officers are rated? What's that percentage?
It's somewhere around 4% of the total Air Force.
Okay, so if that's the answer, I think the numbers beg that we should probably be doing what's going to get to and be most helpful for the most airmen. And I see your point. Yes, this is a pilot's Air Force. This is what we do. This is the family business. But it's not the only business. And it's not even most of the business when it comes to the type of leadership we need to develop and the type of training and leadership environment that airmen are going to find themselves in. So I think that's my first go-to on why I think we need to prepare airmen to lead other airmen more than we need them to be technically savvy. I think they're different skill sets, and I think that's why I think our ROTC OTS are built the way they are.
That's fair. My thought on that is the majority of what we do is not sortie generating. The majority of the Air Force is what we would call nonners, right? But is that really true? No, that's not really true, because the Air Force exists to project air power. Everything that we do is designed to enable the flying mission, whatever the flying mission is, be it an actual aircraft with ordnance attached to it, or the space mission. Obviously, that's now moving over to the Space Force. Anything else that we do is all about enabling air power.
Yep, but that's only the tip of the spear. And the shaft, the handle, is very long. It is what we do. It is what we exist for. But the long wooden handle that is attached to that spear is much bigger and must be given attention. So, yes, we carefully and very deliberately develop people for what they need to do. And we're very good at building pilots. We're good at that. I have no question, absolute faith in what our folks do at UPT, and they develop excellent, excellent pilots. But I think if you have to build a single program that you have to geographically distribute and you have to teach to the single common denominator, I think it's got to be more focused on the most airmen, which are going to be support, which are non-ers.
Yeah. Well, Reed, what did you think about the discussion that Slider and I had about mental health of the officer, especially those that are involved in kinetic operations, you know, in combat?
Yeah, I really, really appreciated his willingness to be vulnerable and to discuss that openly and freely. I think that is essential to not only his personal mental health, but the mental health of those around him, that they feel that they are allowed to not be okay. I have had significant struggles with my mental health post my deployment. And I try to share those experiences with others. Recently had a close friend of mine return from their first deployment. And I see a lot of the similar setting that I found myself in. And I think it's very likely that this person may encounter some of the same challenges I had. And I did openly discuss the struggles I had, and I'm happy to do that here, if you'll oblige me for just a minute. And this is all kind of part and parcel to the story, so just hang with me here for a minute. Again, went to Kayak with Al Udeed. Pretty safe location. I went downtown to Doha regularly. I drove, you know, we've talked about this, the indoor go-karts that were pretty much unregulated and way faster than they should be, but boy, a lot of fun. I had 3 squares a day. I had pretty good billeting, but I also had a lot of stress. I remember just getting off the bus, walking into the building, my heart rate would go up and it would peg at about like 130 and it would stay there for 14 hours. And then I'd go back to my room and it would take me 4 to 6 hours to come down from that just go, 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 super important decision-making all the time. Every phone call was a disaster. You know, 2 or 3 star generals walking in the room yelling all the time. And then I'd just do it over again every day. And I went from that and I moved back to Hawaii to be with my beautiful family on literally paradise on earth. And all I wanted to do was be downrange with my brothers and sisters, bringing the fight to the enemy, living in, frankly, not great conditions compared to my island paradise. And then I got mad at myself for not being okay. And then it became like this spiral, right? So I'm angry that I'm not downrange, bringing the fight to the enemy. Why am I not happy here at home when I have everything? I live in this glorious place. What's wrong with me? I wasn't even in physical danger. And then it was just like this dark spiral. And it took me about a year to get to a good place, talking to mentors, talking to people I trusted, talked to some people at church, talked to some people at work, and just kind of working through everything. And bottom line, I felt that what I was doing was really important. And I had to come to peace with it was okay for me to miss combat. It was okay that I missed my family, but that I wanted to be away from them. And that I had to come to grips with that duality, if you will, that I think I'm not alone in that experience, that, you know, we come back from these experiences and we miss it. I missed the brotherhood. I missed the high impact. I missed the trust that senior leaders had given me, and I missed being good at what I was doing. and the immediacy of the result. And I went back to people not listening to what I had to say because I was just a young lieutenant. I went back to a job that wasn't as impactful as or as rewarding. And so I missed it. And I appreciate that Slider took the time to kind of share his story a little bit. And even in our short time in the Air Force, Colin, I feel like things have changed when it comes to dealing with your mental health as they would your physical health or your fiscal health or your social health or any of the other aspects of who we are. And I'm grateful for that change and I hope it continues. And so that's why I wanted to share with you and with our audience, I've had struggles and I've had people help me. And you are not broken if you are having a hard time. One of the big things that helped me turn the corner was the story of Chris Kyle. I realized that if someone that badass could have a hard time, someone like me who is not that badass can have a hard time and it's okay. And I'll never forget watching that movie one night and just breaking down at the end, just completely lost it and realizing it is okay that I'm not okay. And that next day, my wife looked at me and she grabbed me by my face and she said, "I'm glad that you're finally home." And it had been a full calendar year. So I don't want to scare people, but what we do is hard. And what we do takes a toll on you. It takes a toll on your family. And you can't do this alone. How many times have we said that, Colin? You can't do this by yourself.
I think we're going to say it in every single episode we ever record.
Yeah. So I really appreciated it. Thank you for letting me share. And to anybody in our audience who's struggling, please know that there are people around you that care and are happy to help. There are many resources. Turn to your shirt, turn to your superintendent, turn to your commander, turn to your supervisor, military one source, you name it. There are people out there who are happy to help you get to a good place.
Yeah. And you can count us in that group of people that are happy to help. Obviously, our ability to support you is going to be limited based on the technology that's available and the environment that we're in right now with coronavirus. But now is even more important of a time for us to come together and check in with one another and make sure that everybody is doing okay. Whether the mental health struggles that you're dealing with are combat related or not, I fully understand and agree with you, Reed. I know exactly where you're coming from on wanting to be back in that environment. But the reality is that you may have mental health issues from a huge variety of things. Infinite number of things can lead you down that path where you find yourself in a dark place. And so now, while we are all separated, and let's recognize that there are those who are still bringing the fight to the enemy despite what's going on in the world with coronavirus. And we need to be aware of those people too. But know that the invitation is open to anyone who is listening to this podcast or otherwise, that you can reach out to us. Reed and I will be happy to talk to you, to counsel with you. We're not professionals. We don't claim to be that at all, but we can at least listen and help you get to that better place.
Yeah. And I think if I could just give one last little thing, if our audience took away one thing, it's that I would want it to be that we are all each other's best wingmen and we are here for anybody at any time. And that is the most important thing to me about being a member of the United States Air Force, is I know across this planet, I've got 400,000 people on my side at any moment. And if I pick up a phone and I'm in a place where I need help, they're going to do whatever it takes. And I've seen it. I've experienced it. I've helped other people and we are happy to do that again. But I really want to leave our audience with that. We're here for you. We're here for each other. That's what it's all about.
All right. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Commission Ed.
Thank you for listening to Commission Ed, the Air Force Officer Podcast. The views and opinions of the authors expressed herein do not state or reflect those of the government and shall not be used for advertising or product endorsement purposes. Mention of any specific commercial products, process, or service by trade name, trademark, manufacture, or otherwise does not necessarily constitute nor imply its endorsement, recommendation, or favoring by the U.S. government. The mention of companies by name is solely for the purpose of discussion and should not be implied as endorsement.